Hi and welcome. I'm Daniel Rickaman, your mayor and guide to everything that's happening around town. Deep dive with us into the heart of the best kept secret in the Southeast, Columbia, South Carolina. From the buzzing culinary scene to the business trailblazers pushing our city's boundaries, we're here to give you an insider's glimpse into the vibrant tapestry of people, places, and opportunities that make Columbia unparalleled. Thanks for tuning in, and without further ado, let's jump right into the show. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Around Town. We've got a great guest today, Dale Marshall. Some of you know who he is. Some of you don't, but you're about to. Dale's going to give us a little, he's celebrating, his business is celebrating their 35th anniversary. So we're going to allow him to kind of ease in and give us a brief history of his business that's here in town. I'm going to let him tell you what it is, because that's part of this segment is that you get to learn. And then we're going to dive deep into some of his cool projects he's done and talk a little bit about the impact that he has had personally and professionally in Columbia. And I think once Dale gets start talking, you go, oh, I know that building, or I've been down that road. I know where that is. So Dale, welcome to Around Town.
Great to be here. Good to talk to you.
Good. Well, hey, give us the whole 911 on your business. 35 years. That's incredible.
It is. And it's hard to imagine that it's actually been that long. I moved here in 1987. And went into business with my uncle at the time, Alan Marshall, who's passed away about a decade ago. But Alan and I started this business. We had both been working for a previous company that Alan was a partner in, and we spun out and started Architrave in 1987, and been going ever since then. And we've really, you know, like any small business, we started off doing what we could find. So we had, you know, started out doing work for shopping center developers and lots of other people like that, and always have done some houses. And over time, the housing component has gotten to be a bigger and bigger part of it. We've grown the business around Columbia, as well as, you know, reached into the Charleston market and do a good bit of work down there. My cousin, who's Alan's son, has been with us for a little over a decade and lives down there. So we do a lot of work down there as well as the work here. And, you know, just at this point, try to find projects that interest us and do work that interests us, so we can, keep it fun.
Dale, so I have to ask, Architrave, what's the story behind the name? You didn't just pick that out of the dictionary.
No, we didn't pick it out of the dictionary. It's a real word. It's the beam in the classic Greek order. We picked it because it sounded architectural, but didn't have our name in it. I interned in college for a firm that started out as Atwood Skinner and Associates, and then it was Skinner Lamb, and then it was Skinner Lamb and Highsmith, and it was Skinner Lamb, Highsmith and Hood. And then Highsmith left for a while, and it was back to Skinner Lamb and Hood. And then, you know, and every time you would work there, and every time somebody left or came, the stationery changed and the print sheets changed. And so we wanted a name that did not have our name in it, so that, you know, one, it would be something that would last, and two, when those random salespeople called, they wouldn't just ask for Mr. Architrave. They would, you know, that you could let them talk to different people. So it's made it much more flexible, but it is an architectural term, and it sounds like a name that could be an architect's name.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I laugh when you brought up the stationery change. I remember working for a law firm part-time when I was still in school. And I mean, they changed partners like some people change suits. And I mean, I felt like every day I was going to a printer to pick up new business cards and new stationery, which is crazy.
Yeah. I'd gone through that, and that just was not something I wanted. And it's allowed for growth and allowed for people to come in and people to go without it, you know, with the name of the firm still preserved. So
That's great. Well, I know the areas of focus, y'all really focused on residential and commercial design, but I think the piece that a lot of people may not realize is how much you are involved, especially here in Columbia and in Charleston in historic preservation. Can you talk about how did y'all decide to really become a premier architect firm in that industry?
It has always been something that interested me. I mean, my first job out of school was working for a firm in Charleston where all we did was historic preservation projects. It's always been the kind of work that I find interesting. I think it's, you know, what gives the soul to a community if you can preserve a certain amount of buildings. And so every time we have found the opportunity to get a good preservation project and a client who wants to do things, we've certainly gone out of our way to pursue that work and to make sure we get that work. We had a client years ago, Ray and Pat's Carter, who owned, you know, a number of buildings, bought some buildings on Main Street, the Canal Dime Savings Bank for one. And, you know, we had done a renovation for a historic house that he owned out in Chapin before we did the work down here. And when that project came, we certainly pursued that and, you know, worked to develop that relationship. Again, great clients and, you know, and just a lot of fun to see something that had been once a grand bank building and then had devolved into a wig shop before we got it that was filled to the brim with stuff in the basement. It, you know, in between, it had been historically renovated as an Eckerd's drugstore and, you know, but that had moved out probably a decade before we got involved with the project. And, you know, our goal was to try to, on that project, find a purpose. And we created some living units upstairs. There had been, once it had been converted to the Eckerd's back in the mid-30s, the upstairs had been abandoned. There was a boiler, you know, sitting in the middle of the big room up there, and no one had taken the stair out. There was no way to get there except for either a spiral stair that was tucked in the back or someplace from an outside ladder. So it was just a really cool experience to get deeply involved and, you know, dig in, find the history of the building, figure out what point we wanted to take it back to and preserve. And we, you know, we worked on that and did it. We did a law office down the street for on Laurel Street for James Smith years ago. Again, a really interesting building from the turn of the last century, and, you know, again, find out the details of it. So each building sort of gives you its own history and place to go, but they're just really interesting projects because if they've made it, you know, if the building has made it 100 plus years, then obviously people have found some purpose for it, you know, for a reason why it's still there. And you just try to do the best you can to put it back in the condition where it should be. We spent 2 years working on the old Newbury Hotel project, which is the sort of iconic building in downtown Newbury with the red tower roof. And again, we had a great client, Joe and Mary McDonald, that had bought the building and wanted to see it put back together as something to represent Newbury. And we spent a lot of time figuring out what it had been before and trying to bring it back to that. I mean, the whole upper level of it was completely had been abandoned for a half century when we got onto it. So they're like puzzles that you try to put them together, but a lot of fun.
When you take on a project, I mean, talk a little bit about some of the challenges just to get to the point that you can represent it, you know, in on paper. Hey, this is what we're going to do, and this is why. I mean, you talked a little bit about the research, finding out the history and how that, but talk about some of the challenges in these projects. And to me, I think that's part of what you like is the challenge part.
Yeah, and each one is different, but like for the Canal Dime Savings Bank, I spent days at the Carolinian Library looking up, you know, old drawings. They have records from, I think there had been a LaFay renovation of the project somewhere in the early 19-teens. And we found some of those drawings. We found photographs. There are photographs in the Richland County Library. They have photographs of Main Street. And so you're getting all of that to try to see what's there that's, what was there that's not there anymore, and try to figure out how to put things back. You're trying to look at the context of the buildings that were around and, you know, draw a path of how we got to where we are, and then, you know, find a reasonable way to go back. And then there's a whole, there are definitely standards put out by the Department of the Interior that guide historic preservation projects. And there are things that you have to get reviewed at the state level. You know, if you're going for certain tax credits and those kind of things, those don't apply to every project, but they apply to some. So there is a lot of research. There's a lot of figuring out, you know, what's possible. I mean, you've got structural limitations from the old buildings, and you have to, you know, take those into account. And you also have to accept that every building, you know, is of its time and place, but its function may have changed. And so you've got to find out a new purpose that it will work at as well.
When you've embarked in that, you're back there, you're doing the history, you're starting to draw things out. The next question would be is, are there enough builders who understand how to do that in today's world? I mean, because it is, it's got its own challenges in, and there's a lot of work, and a lot of it's handwork. You know, I know a lot of people today try to cut corners and find the easiest way, you know, pre-built panels and things like that. That does not work in a renovation project. Are we losing a generation of folks who understand that, or are we still in a good place that, you know, you can preserve? Because my favorite thing about traveling is seeing old structures. Europe does the best. I mean, you can have a building that's from the 1300s or the 1700s next to a beautiful glass building, and it works. Yep. You know,
there are still builders who are capable of doing, you know, high detail work. They're not a ton of them, and you've also got to find, you know, depending on the scale of the project and the complexity, you may be able to have a really great crew with one or two people who can do it if you were renovating an older house. If you've got something that's, you know, like the Newbury Hotel was, where you're talking about 30 or 40,000 square feet of building, then you've also got to have somebody who can manage a crew that can do a much bigger project. And these, we haven't done them, but these huge mill projects, again, you've got to bring in somebody who can manage the scale of the project while also achieving the level of detail. So it does depend on the project. There are still good craftsmen out there. There are still people who apprentice through, and we see them particularly on the residential side, you know, who have great, you know, great trim skills and finish skills. But that's one of those things that you definitely have to look for, and frankly, you have to pay for it. You know, if you're going to get somebody who's got
that skill set,
then you're going to have to pay for their skill set, because quality doesn't come cheap.
Especially today, I think the cost of goods, and then obviously having the craftsmen and the quality that's given. And, you know, like you said, if the building's made it 100 years, not only was there a purpose, but it was built right. You know, so, you know, when you got a structure, so replacing that, in your opinion, what makes the Midlands so unique in terms of historic preservation?
There's still a good bit here. I mean, one, there's enough density, and, you know, and again, you define the period. Most of our classic works that we're, you know, dealing with are late 1800s to mid, you know, earlier 1900s. We don't have as much of that, you know, early 1800 building stock as say some of the Charleston or Beaufort might, but, you know, there's still a significant quantity of particularly turn of the, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s. We have a large segment of that work. I mean, you've got the whole Robert Mills district that's filled with sort of late Victorian, early craftsman type houses. You've got whole neighborhoods that, it's hard sometimes to think of places like Melrose Heights and Shandon as being historic neighborhoods because they're mostly built in the 30s and 40s, but they are. I mean, they're pushing, pushing 90.
100, yeah.
Exactly. Pushing towards 100 years. You've got, you know, Forest Hills, which has a ton of stuff from the late 1930s through the early 50s. Again, it is actually historic stock, and they're just large, intact neighborhoods, you know, where there's enough things still left that the neighborhoods have the feel of the neighborhoods. And that's what makes it work. I mean, you look at the whole of the Vista, which is a, you know, warehouse district, but there is enough of the classic warehouse stock from the early 1900s that there's a genuine character to the neighborhood. There's still enough buildings fronting Main Street, you know, from that late 1890s to 1920s era that it's cohesive. You can walk up and down it and feel, even though there are things that have been put in, you still have a sense of cohesive character. So that's here in Columbia, and it's you know, and it's a great part of the character of the city.
What would be an example of a building that you think just really stands out from a preservation project? You know, what do you think that which building is the iconic building downtown that draws people?
There's several of them. You can look at the Dupree Building on Gervais Street as a great example of a, you know, where the Craigs did a fantastic bringing it back. I mean, the building had never really been covered over so much, so it was still there, but it's a great building with great character and detail. The Canal Dime Savings Bank Building, which the South Carolina Center for Architecture is renovating the ground floor now, is a great building on Main Street. The whole block that the Middletons have done there, you know, there from where Bourbon and the Grand and, you know, all of those businesses, the block has a feel and a character to it. I mean, it's of its time and it still feels very historic, yet it also works great, you know, from current use.
If you had to pick a residential house out in the same character, is there a house that you think's iconic here?
I mean, you've got the obvious museum houses, right? The Robert Mills House and the Hampton Preston Mansion, which are, you know, actually older than, you know, early 1800s, yeah, earlier than much of anything else. And they've, you know, and they are their museum quality restorations that stand out. So, I mean, they're hard not to count. Not to count them for what they are, which are, you know, stunning. They were stunning examples when they were first built, and they've been maintained. I mean, the Hampton Preston Mansion obviously had been significantly altered over time, and, you know, someone before I was here did a first rate, you know, historically very accurate job of taking off all the unsympathetic additions that had been done when it was a seminary and various other things, and bringing it back to you know, true historic character. So it's hard not to count those. Now those are solitary examples that, you know, there's just not much else like them. There are great examples scattered through neighborhoods of houses, you know, that people are still living in all through Wells Garden and Forest Hills. You know, that
there's one in Wells Garden on Saluda being redone right now.
And meticulous, you know, obviously someone has done a really, you know, is doing a quality job and is putting the resources into making it come back. A stunning house to begin with.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing the end results. Yeah. I mean, they really full gut everything. And the house down the street that the Blanchards live in now, I mean, beautiful renovation that started with Fran Oxner and then made its way, and another beautiful, those are probably two of my favorite houses that I ride by that I'm like, you know, that would be cool.
And there are probably literally 100 of those scattered through Wells Garden, Hollywood, Rose Hill. That, I mean, one of my associates had just finished up and moved into a house on Wheat Street that was from 1923. You know, he's completely renovated kitchens and systems, but also tried you wouldn't know it's a gorgeous two-story brick house, but you know, it was a fine house when it was built in 1923, and it's had a couple of additions over the century. But you know, again, I always say that, you know, our best projects in that regard, you probably don't notice them. I mean, we try to get in and do a good job, but not do something that, you know, screws up a good thing. So there are a lot of them out there, and they're nicely landscaped in, and you just don't, if you're not paying attention,
you miss it.
You'll miss it and ride right by. But there's some gorgeous houses on Saluda, on Edisto, on Wheat, you know.
We've got some of those contemporary houses that really stick out, you know, Hardin Street and Forest Drive and, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, and the Wallace McGee house on Hardin Street dates to the, I think, the 1930s. So it's actually an old, you know, it's an international style. It looks super modern, but it's actually an 85 or 90 year old house. It's on the National Register. So it's fascinating, you know, and that's part of what makes a great neighborhood is that you've got, I mean, I live on Wheat Street. To me, what makes it a great neighborhood is you've got those singular houses that are stunning, you know, that are special. And you've got very tasteful duplexes and quadplexes from 75 or 80 years ago. And they're all scattered, you know, next to each other and interwoven. And so you've got the opportunity to have, you know, somebody who's got probably north of $3 million invested in a house living next to somebody who's living in a unit in a quadplex that doesn't have to have anywhere near that kind of, you may only be paying $1,200 a month for, you know, a two bedroom apartment but they're in a neighborhood that's, you know, intermixed with some really expensive houses. And that's one of those rare things that doesn't happen in suburbia very much anymore, but it does happen in town. And it's part of what makes town, you know, living in town vital.
Yeah. Since we're talking about residential, maybe you could talk a little bit about the residential design. I know y'all have done a lot of work in that, not just on the historic side, but on residential side. Maybe you can give us some insight about what y'all have done over the last 35 years.
You know, we've done huge in-town renovations on historic houses, but we also have done a number of really nice houses on Lake Murray. And, you know, over the last 10 years, probably 35 or 40 houses on Kiowa Island, you know, which, you know, gives us the opportunity to do really well-detailed, refined construction. You get the budgets that allow for, you know, quality contractors and quality detailing. And those projects are very fulfilling. I mean, you get long-term relationships with clients where you, for a typical new residential project, you know, we may be engaged with the client for almost 2.5 years from the time we first meet till the time, you know, that it gets all closed out and they move in. So you'll have a lot of process of talking to people. We've had multiple people where we'll walk around and visit 3 or 5 lots with them to help them pick the best lot on the lake or the best lot at Kiowa for their particular program needs. And then we go through all the design process and, you know, working it out, getting the program worked out, getting through the review process in these neighborhoods that have pretty extensive architectural review boards and all of that, working through that, working with landscape architects, interior designers, structural engineers, all the other people that are part of the team to get people what they want. And it's from an architect's standpoint, it's very fulfilling work because you get people who are looking to do something that's got a level of quality and permanence, and that's more fun than just cranking out things that, you know, sometimes I've done a lot of commercial work and a chunk of it has not outlasted, you know, me. I mean, you know, I've had a number of commercial projects that have already been torn down or pretty much completely gutted and started over. So I like doing things where the shelf life is more than 15 years.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I get it. I totally get that. So interesting part, when you meet with these clients, I'm curious, I mean, they have a general idea. Hey, I want 4 bedrooms. I want these many baths. how much do you have to dig in to get them to open up so that you really can put that on paper? Because I found that a lot of people have a hard time visualizing. Do they usually show up with clips and pictures and say, hey, this is the style we're looking for? Or are you finding that you're having to dig all that information out?
All of the above. I mean, we have some clients that really have no particular visual imagery. They'll have a program, you know, like you say, we need X number of rooms, and we've got about a 12-page questionnaire that we give people as a start of the process, and they can, you know, that's designed to try to draw that, really designed to try to draw all of that out of them. But some people are good at filling that out and you get it from there. Others, you just sit around a table and talk for a long time. And others, you get in the car and you ride around and you go through, you know, look at things and try to get a sense of what they like. Some people used to come in with notebooks, you know, loose leaf binders where they'd collected pictures from Architectural Digest or Veranda or various magazines. A lot of times now they come in with Pinterest boards, you know, where they share their Pinterest board with you and you can log on and look at the, you know, 600 things they've clipped off of various Pinterest pages.
Wow.
You know, and it's all dependent. I mean, you know, if you're doing something, we're very context driven. So if you're up at the lake, you know, you're looking about, okay, where are the focused views and what are we trying to orient? And that may drive things. If you're on Kiowa, you know, and if the architectural spectrum runs from 0 to 100 on Kiowa, you're allowed to practice between 48 and 53. You know, they're very
tight window.
It's a tight window of what's allowed in terms of materials and heights and, you know, and all of those things. So you have to try to make your designs work within that, you know, limited range of what's going to get approved. And they do that because obviously it's been commercially super successful for them. And, you know, and you don't really want to buck the system because that is what makes the value. And it's sort of like if you're working in a historic neighborhood in Columbia, if there's a vacant lot, you don't want to design a house that's not sympathetic. That doesn't mean it needs to be a recreation of an old house, but it certainly needs to have the scale and balance to fit in to the neighborhood. And Columbia has some neighborhoods that have design review and some neighborhoods that don't. And there's not always a completely rational explanation of how one, you know, there's a political explanation, but not always a fully rational about why some restrictions exist in one place and not the other. But if you're working in one of those neighborhoods that has restrictions, then you try to make sure that what you're doing, you know, works within that, because a super interesting project that doesn't get approved is just paper. It's not a building. So you got to get things approved.
What do you see in residential? What do you see the future looking like in residential design? We are hearing a lot of folks, because we have such an aging population, looking to downsize, but yet still want quality and amenities, but want less space. And you know, we're interesting. Columbia is not set up right now. Everything is for single family. And, you know, I'm hearing folks, I want townhouse. I want a duplex that, you know, I can live on one side and rent out the other. I have a little income coming in, or, you know, I want to have a place next door my kids can live in, but I don't want to have to maintain everything year round. I mean, what are you seeing, hearing, or trending? What do you think we're looking at for the future?
It's a hard to pin that down. I mean, I thought after the economic downturn in 2009 that we would see houses potentially get smaller, and had a lot of discussions in the office about what would happen. Completely wrong. There's been no, you know, in the last 14 years, there's been no sense that anything is getting smaller. And obviously the sort of 5-year boom period where interest rates were low, I think drove a lot of people towards bigger things because they're, you know, they could afford more. Clearly, you know, in my lifetime, the average house has grown, not so much the architect designed house, but just the average house has grown something like 35 or 40%. I mean, people's space you know, requirements just seem to get bigger and bigger. There's got to be some cap on that. There's got to be some rational, you know, cap. But, you know, the typical new house client for us is a couple in their early 50s whose last child is probably, you know, in their last year or so of college. And they talk about downsizing, but usually the only thing that gets downsized is the size of the lot. You know, they end up building a house. I'm sure you've been in numerous ones and seen them. The house itself ends up being bigger than the house they raised three kids in, but the yard is a lot smaller. And so the downsizing is just scaling.
I'm laughing hysterically because I see that all the time. I've had so many friends, oh, we're downsizing. You come to their house. I'm like, this house is bigger than the house you just moved from. Like, yeah, but you're right. The lot's smaller. Yeah. I got less maintenance. I'm like, well, you do maybe in the yard, but you still got maintenance three floors up.
You have two more baths than you had when you had three kids in the house. You know, you've got all those things. And I, you know, and I'm an architect, not people's counselor. So, I mean, at some point, if that's what they want, that's what we do. But there is a level of, it's at some point you do sense that that's going to all need to be thought through. And I agree with you, the idea, what I was talking about earlier, the idea where you have duplexes scattered in and quadplexes scattered into neighborhoods. I certainly think that, you know, government has an opportunity to make sure zoning allows that. I mean, we went through starting really in the 60s and, you know, and we've begun to see in the last decade and a half some change of that. But we really went through a period where everything was very tightly zoned to make everything the same. And you can look at subdivisions built in Columbia, you know, in the 90s and 2000s, where you'll have this main road and off of this road will be houses, you know, in the 300s to 340s. And the next road will be houses in the 400s to 450s and across 500s to 550s. And it's like, why particularly do people living in the one house not need to be on the same block as other people? There's no good explanation for that, but that's the zoning and development trend. And I certainly hope that, you know, that we get back to more of the intermingling.
Because I think we're going to have to. I think the needs are changing dramatically, especially even the young. I mean, the millennials today are not interested in buying a house in Rosewood and building up equity. They want an apartment. They want to live downtown. They want all the amenities with none of the headache and being able to just lock the door and go, well, I'm going to China for a week. I'll be back. You know, I mean, it's very interesting to see, but I'm seeing this trend with baby boomers. You know, we got a whole segment of population that's single moms with no kids at home. They're looking for product that we don't have. And so you're right. I think when your description of Shandon and what makes it cool and Melrose Heights is that was blended up. I mean, one of the coolest houses in Melrose Heights is a triplex.
Yeah.
I mean, today, if you wanted to go do that, everybody'd be up in arms. Oh, Lord, but that's what we need.
And I mean, you literally have things like the, you know, building of apartments that back up next to single family houses. And it makes for vibrant living because it means that, you know, someone who's 1 year out of college who doesn't have the equity to go buy a $400,000 starter home, which is where they start now, you know, can be there, you know. And so, I mean, it is nice. I mean, I live in an old shotgun house that, you know, was built in the early 30s and doesn't have but two bedrooms. And, you know, it's just, but I also, you know, that's not mostly what we do. We mostly do things that are much bigger because that's who hires architects.
You know? Yeah. I'd love to find a lot downtown that I could build a house. I mean, I'm on the back end. It was funny when I was younger, we wanted everything bigger. We accumulated. Now we're trying to get rid of stuff and downsize and have more of a simple life. I mean, in an ideal world, I have a big kitchen. It's connected to a den and a fireplace and one big room. And it's a couple bedrooms off the side. I'm done. I don't need a formal dining room anymore. Yeah. I mean, it's just that, and my kids, they're not interested. That generation's not interested in having that, you know. They love it at Christmas, but you know, that Christmas and Thanksgiving, I'm not build a dining room for two meals a year.
Nobody wants grandma's china.
Yeah. You know, no matter, you know, if you, I love that stuff. That's the crazy part.
I know. I have, you know, family members that have sets services for 12, you know, and it's like, no one wants it. You know, when they go to downside, just like, it's just not what people are.
And I think hopefully that'll come around, because I do think that, to me, having an elegant dinner party and doing those things, there's fun. And we actually, in our house, we turned our living room into a dining room because it was bigger and it had a fireplace, and we love to entertain and have people over and enjoy it. We don't ever use what was the dining room and living room. It really is just, it's got furniture in it and it's just a room. But that part, I love having that big dining table and having people, but I'd also love to have it where I could be cooking in the kitchen and just talking to them right across from me.
So, and a lot of these houses we do on the coast, you know, still have a table that seats 10 or 12, but it's not a separate, it's not a separate room. It is, like you say, it's open to the kitchen. You're sitting there looking at the marsh, and you know, you can stand there at your island cooking and see the dinner guest and then put the food out in front. And it's a much more, and that's not bad. I mean, I grew up, you know, where we set the table on Sunday meals in the dining room, and, you know, stemware and everything, silver and the whole bit. And it is, you know, it's something you don't see as much of, but you still can entertain. Just, it's a more open, casual environment.
Yeah. But I love mixing those pieces because, you know, my parents are deceased and we have all their china and stuff. And we got my mother-in-law's, we got multiple sets, and we love it's, for me, it's fun preparing the meal, having people. But it's interesting as I watch these renovations in my neighborhood happen. I mean, all of that's going away. All of it's going away. It's just, they're just changing. Not the outside, but the interiors is a totally different layout, which is also can be challenging.
It can be. And you know, and you want to make the house work for that. That's how these neighborhoods survive, though, is that people, and this is not the first, you know, one we just did on Wheat Street. You know, we weren't the first renovation in 100 years. We were the third major renovation in 100 years. People had added rooms and done other things, you know, and you could sort of date back when it was done. But that's how the neighborhoods stay vibrant, is that people keep doing that. And I think, you know, what people are drawn to is just they're drawn to the sidewalks. They're drawn to the fact that, you know, you can walk into Five Points, or you can, you know, you can take an evening walk for 2 miles and stay on sidewalks. And that just doesn't happen outside of downtown. And so, I mean, it's really, you know, I say that. I mean, we also have done a lot of work in Daniel Island, and they've recreated some of those same effects, but there are not many places that have recreated that. And that's what people are drawn to. That's what I'm drawn to. That's why I, you know, why I live where I live, is because, you know, when I moved here 36 years ago, 35 years ago, I did not want to live out in suburb. I did not want to commute. I wanted to be 2 miles from my office so that, you know, I don't spend my day sitting on the interstate coming into town or going home at night. And there are a lot of people who do. And, you know, and
some people thrive on that. It's interesting.
Yeah. They listen to your podcast, I guess.
Listen to a podcast, or, you know, I've talked to a guy. He's like, I like commuting because I get everything out of my mind and head. So when I'm at home, I'm with my family. I'm not thinking about work. And I'm like, that works for you. I like my 5-minute commute. Yeah. I can bury that before I get home. And, but everybody's different, you know, and some people want bigger lots and, you know, less neighbors. I mean, you know, it's so interesting to see, but I see this influx of, and people moving downtown. We have more requests for more housing downtown, you know, more towers, people that, condos. I heard the word condo for the first time in 2 decades.
Yeah.
And people are like, they're like, we want condos. We want to be live in a building that we share amenities with folks, and that I can walk to work or walk to the Coger Center or walk to the river. And they're like, we need more towers downtown. We need more people. So it's very interesting to see how we have this shift again.
We got enough surface parking lots that can build them. There's no shortage of land to put those. You know, I keep telling people that I love Columbia, but we could literally have 8 or 10 times the number of people living in the, you know, 2 mile radius of downtown that live
and a mile of it's all parking lots. Yeah. You know, we talked about that. And one of the things that we've been meeting with development teams in other cities that have done that. We're like, look, you know, cause people always say there's not enough parking. I'm like, have you ever been to the Capital City Club and looked around Columbia? Go there at 10 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning. I don't care when it is. There are thousands of empty parking spots. Yeah. We don't need all that, but think about if we had people and living units downtown, what our downtown would look like with people walking all over, filled. I mean, we wouldn't have any empty retail spaces. We wouldn't have any empty restaurant spaces.
It's the solution to everything in terms of, you know, everything people, anything someone complains about, mostly the solution is actually more people living down here.
I'm glad you said that. And for those of you who are listening, listen to Dale. He's been here for 35 years designing, building, and taking care of preservation. He knows more people is a good thing.
Yes. I mean, I would love to see, you know, 400,000 or 500,000 people living in the greater downtown area. Because, again, if they live down here, we don't have to spend billions of dollars creating interstates to get them in and out of town. We don't have to, you know. It solves so many things.
It does. It really does. All right. 35 years. What's the next chapter look like?
For me, I think it's continuing the same. I mean, I think I'm going to keep going, you know, at least another decade, assuming something doesn't happen. We've got a niche that, you know, the business has sort of developed what I really like to do. So, you know, it will be somebody else that changes the direction if it changes. There are other people involved, and somewhere down the road, someone may take it in a different direction. But for me, you know, continuing to do this mix of preservation and nice residential projects, it's what I really enjoy. It's what I'm comfortable with. So I keep doing it. And again, I certainly hope I have another decade at it. It's not a lot of heavy lifting, so it's one of those careers that you don't hit your peak, you know, in a physical thing. You hit it as long as you've got some mental capacity and want to keep going.
I have to ask, because, all right, so when you finished a project, I mean, it's done, and you're sitting there looking at it, how do you celebrate? Because you got to be celebrating, because the average time from design to building, I'm talking more probably the preservation and the residential than, you know, as you mentioned, shopping centers come and go quick. Yeah. Those are easy. But when you look around, like at Kiowa, when you're done with one of these properties and you've spent 2.5 years with folks, how do you celebrate that?
You know, ideally you wait till it's in a good point, and then you hire a photographer and you go get pictures made of it. So you have a record. That's one way. When we finished Newberry, I actually had my 60th birthday party there and had 110 people. You know, we did an event and actually had people come and celebrate it with us. So that felt like a conclusion. Sometimes, you know, it's different every time. Sometimes people get in too early and, you know, you never really feel like it finishes because you're stringing out all the little things while they're living in it. But yeah, I guess the best way is once the pictures are taken, then you can kind of say it's, you know, that one is done, and you can move on until they're ready to. You know, we have had projects we did where we came back 7 years later and did a renovation. So it's different every time.
That's great. Well, Dale, thanks for being here. I appreciate you sharing. Congratulations on 35 years. I think we might be celebrating here. We keep talking 36 year, but really appreciate what you've done downtown. You know, folks, I got to add this to what Dale didn't tell you is that he was very involved in a lot of our committees at the city, spent a lot of time on the DDRC, is really one of the people behind what the Vista is today. He very involved in making sure that we captured a lot of that, but also is a proponent of growth too. So he understands you got to have both and there's a way to do it. And so next time you ride through the Vista or you're down in Arsenal Hill or you're riding through Shandon, think about what Dale shared with you. Take a look. Look a little closer at that building. Look a little closer at that house and think about it. Some of those have been here longer than you probably know your family history. And it's all right there in our doorstep, which is what makes Columbia unique and why we're going to be the number one city in South Carolina before it's all said and done. Dale, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Silently celebrate.